The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're thinking about science as an instrument and the parallels between an understanding of music and the history of science. A little later on, we'll talk to Vaughn Masefield of the University of Western Sydney about a project that translates neural impulses into audible sound. But first, let's learn about how the history of music and the history of science are connected. Today's guest is Tom Levinson, professor of science writing at MIT and author of Newton and the Counterfeiter, and before that, of Einstein in Berlin. He's also a filmmaker, most recently of the Origins miniseries on the PBS program Nova. Our guest host, Marie-Claire Shanahan, had Tom on the show a few months ago, and we invited him back to talk with us about a book that he wrote way back in 1994. It's Measure for Measure, A Musical History of Science. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Thank you so much. You are a glutton for punishment.
I very much enjoyed that interview, I have to say, which is why you're here. So this book, sir, is broad. You explain how scientific thought has changed throughout history, and you use musical instruments as examples. So why did you decide that music was the best way of illustrating science?
Well, it wasn't so much music that was my starting point as the word and the concept of an instrument. You know, way, way back in 1985, I think it was, which was the 300th centenary of Bach, something like that. It was some anniversary for Bach. I did a radio program when I was first training to become a filmmaker and documentary maker. And I looked at, and the radio piece I made that never aired anywhere because I was so incompetent, was all about, what Bach was doing when he wrote the well-tempered clavier, the well-tempered keyboard, those compositions that, if you've ever had anyone in your house or if you've studied classical piano yourself, probably when you just start getting good, you start playing, you know, that out of that collection of wonderful pieces. They were in fact a collection that I believe Bach wrote to help his son learn how to play the keyboard. But anyway, I said, you know, I just said out of curiosity, what does it mean to be well-tempered? And that sort of sent me right down the rabbit hole of issues of acoustics and the physics of sound and tuning and how we come to hear music that is or isn't, quote, out of tune in some abstract sense. And I started thinking about all the ideas that were contained in something as seemingly static and just sort of instrumental as a piano keyboard. And that same year, I met a man who was the world's greatest light microscopist, and he showed me this microscope he'd been sort of accreting, and not so much building, but accreting by hand since shortly after the Second World War. So this is 40 years of building this ever more capable, ever larger, ever more frightening instrument. And he'd recently added, this was 85, remember, actually this visit, yeah, it was 85, and he had a camera that could fly around, essentially, that could give you a 3D look at something he was observing. And he showed me a picture of a highly magnified nerve cell with these little filaments and hanging off it and little balls at the end of the filaments. He said, that's where some people think memory lives. And I said, wow, and it's an instrument. And this progressive improvement of the instrument to the point where 10 years ago he couldn't possibly have made that image. 5 years ago the image would have been there, but it would have been indistinct, and now he could see it, and it was leading people to think in a new way about the physical structure of memory at that time. And between both of those things happened within a couple months in 1985, and I just started thinking about it, and I realized that instruments in science do two things. They answer the questions that you build into them, that you design into them. You build something because you want to know about something. You build a telescope of a certain size or an instrument and all kinds of different, more complicated instruments. And at the same time, I noticed that you know, musicians use instruments to do things, to, in some senses, discover things at the same time. And that got me thinking, what if there's an overlap between the ways these two seemingly very different domains and these two different communities actually overlap? And will that give me an insight? You know, I love music and I was interested, but really what I was after is, will that give me an insight into how scientists think and what science does and how those two things changed perhaps over the time since we began really doing that systematic inquiry into nature that we have come to call science?
Well, and you say that music and science have actually been intertwined in Western thinking since their origins.
This is a book that's almost 20 years old. It's more than 20 years old in terms of the thinking and writing. And I've learned a lot since then. I've grown older and have much creakiness to show for it. So I'm not sure that everything I thought back then is still what I would think now. But the big, broad outline, that I think still holds true. In fact, it's guided a lot of what I've thought about how to think about science and maybe even how to communicate it to people. And so the basic thing I notice is that in the early stages, from the Greeks through the Middle Ages, music was actually in its own way a kind of science. You performed inquiry into nature, or you demonstrated principles of nature through the development of musical ideas, their expression in musical instruments, and their transmission through those instruments to audiences that would encounter them. And you see this from, you know, the beginnings with the great legends of Pythagoras, you know, the great legend that he discovered the whole number ratios of the intervals in the musical scale, the octave, the fifth, the fourth, by hanging weights off strings. This is not, in fact, this, as described, it didn't happen. It couldn't have happened the way it described because the weights are wrong and they missed, you know, the fact that you have to do squares of things rather than just additive and all that sort of stuff. But the underlying insight is true. There are numerical ratios, whole number ratios. A note one octave higher than the note you start with is twice the frequency. There are 5-to-4 ratios, 4-to-3, 3-to-2. 3-to-2 ratios is what we call the fifth now. That's the note from C to G, this kind of thing. And those are all, you know, those are all real. And the Greeks identified them. They identified them rigorously using probably not weights on strings, but something called a monochord, which is a stringed instrument with just a single string that you can stop. That is, you can you know, press down on the fretboard as if it were a guitar, press down on the neck as if it were a violin, and get precise ratios, you know, 2/3 of the string below the stop and 1/3 above and this kind of thing, and make really fundamental discoveries about, with just that simple instrument, see that word again, make really fundamental discoveries about the physics of sound. And people did that. I mean, they really tried to inquire about nature using this, and they also built musical systems out of it. And you see this interaction between science, I mean, it's really sort of anachronistic to call it science, but systematic inquiry, the development of instruments to perform that with ever greater precision, and then the development of ones to demonstrate what you know when you get to the wonderful and just enormously rich and interesting Greek invention of the pipe organ, which is where the book really sort of gets going, looking at the history of the pipe organ, which when I went into this, I had no idea it was so cool, and coming out of it, I'm still amazed by it.
Well, now, you've written the book in three sections, and the sections are loosely built around sort of what kinds of questions science was asking at particular points in history. So that first section deals with the apparent order in nature and how scientific thought mainly was focusing on questions about what that order could tell us about the mind of God. So maybe tell us about that.
As you say, the book is in three sections. And in one sense, the first section talks about how people identified patterns and represented those patterns as really reflections of something that God was doing with the creation. But the mind of God in this first period, well, it's you know, when Pythagoras developed his first theories of the ordering of the universe, he ordered it on musical principles. He said, you know, you can see how the whole cosmos is organized around the same ratios that Pythagoras and his followers identified in music, and there are these formal relationships, and you have this sort of single unifying theory that explains, you know, everything. You know, if you can penetrate deeply enough to find the fundamental patterns, you see how whatever the divine may be, you see how that divine has organized all that we see around us. In some ways, it's It's not a modern idea, but there are modern ideas that echo that as we look for fundamental theories that can, you know, way beneath the surface of experience, account for, in some sense, account for the entire organization of the cosmos. There is a big leap from ancient ideas of a unified theory of the universe and modern ones, but there are echoes. There is a human impulse in trying to understand everything through very elementary ideas.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Tom Levinson, professor of science writing at MIT and author of Measure for Measure, A Musical History of Science.
My deep desire when I published this book was to title it Measure for Measure, The Musical, but they wouldn't let me.
Noted, sir. Now, you've used the organ to talk about sort of that order of nature, initial kind of thought, that phase. So what's its history?
The organ is really fantastic because it actually cuts across the history of both science and technology in really interesting ways. The first organ, I mean, the person who's always identified as the inventor of the organ is somebody named Ctesibios of Alexandria. I'm probably, if there are Greek speakers in the audience, it's spelled Ctesibios. And he flourished in the Hellenistic period in the city of Alexandria, which was a great center and probably the one, you know, really first rank city in the Greek world that did not just sort of abstract theory, which was, you know, something that the Greeks were very good at, but actually really practical invention. This is the same, you know, the same school out of which Archimedes came and a number of other people who are very highly regarded. Anyway, Ctesibios is best known for being essentially a hydraulic engineer. He invented a form of pump that became widespread throughout the ancient world, used in fire suppression. He used a hydraulically driven mechanism to create a bird whistle that you'd have water draining that would compress air that would fly it out through the that would send it out through a tube that would lead it to a whistle. And you build it in the shape of a bird, and he invented the organ. Now, in order to get an organ, you need basically three things. You need a stable supply of air. You need pipes of very precise lengths organized to create a pleasing sequence of musical sounds. And you need some means of controlling the flow of air into those pipes so you can decide you're going to play a C now and a G then and so forth and so on. You know, what we... Now we now use for that a keyboard, but that wasn't always the case. The amazing thing is Ctesibios seems to have invented all three of those elements. He didn't invent actually a keyboard. It was part of the organ from the beginning, and then it was later lost. People used levers to pull in the Middle Ages rather than a keyboard, which means that you have one hand, one note control of the instrument instead of one finger, one note, much less, you know, sort of musically flexible. So Ctesibios and of those three things, Pythagoreans already knew about cutting pipes to the appropriate length to give you the correct sounds, the sounds you wanted. The keyboard was, you know, it's an advance, but it's if you have fretted instruments like a, you know, some kind of ancient guitar-like instrument or anything, or even just an instrument with a neck like the presumed monochord, you can imagine setting up a control system. The real trick there was getting air stored. And the way he did that was he created a system in which there was an air pump, which had an intake valve that drew air into the cylinder, and an outflow valve, which led to a conduit that carried the compressed air down to the pygnius, it was called. It was a hemisphere of brass with an outlet at the bottom through which water from the cistern could flow. And that was sort of the regulator of the system. It was very complex. It was really good engineering. And when he had it, his wife is said to have been the first organist, and the system was called a hydraulis in honor of its water based system. And this became a design that became widespread throughout the ancient world. What's interesting is it was a demonstration of fundamental principles. It had the same, you know, ratios of notes that the Pythagoreans were interested in the ratios, the lengths of the different pipes that were used to make the sound. It demonstrated really fundamental ideas about the compressibility and incompressibility of substances using water, which isn't compressible to, you know, basically drive the air through the entire system. And it was a fairly, you know, complicated piece of just, you know, building the carpentry and metalworking and all that sort of stuff needed to make the thing go was, you know, the highest technology of the time and remained so for the next 1,200 years or so. I mean, this was as good as it got.
You're right. It was the pinnacle of technological advancement at that point. And so, therefore, it wasn't only seen as a musical instrument. It was also seen as a symbol of state power.
Exactly. I mean, the single thing in this whole book that surprised me the most was the way in which you could see the pipe organ as the Saturn V, you know, Apollo moonshot of the Middle Ages. And I came to that conclusion when I encountered, and I honestly at this point, though these many years on, don't remember how I found it, a translated, of course, court ode to the Frankish court in the Frankish Empire. A grandson or perhaps great-grandson, I'm a little hazy at this distance, of Charlemagne, managed to commission and have built the first organ that has been identified in the Western Empire, Western Europe, since the fall of Rome. There had been organs continuously in Byzantium, which claimed to be the heir to the entire Roman Empire and the sort of obligatory center of civilization. And there's this ode saying, oh, no. We Frankish kings now have our organ, and you must bow down to us. We're the best. I actually just found the poem in the book. Even the organ never yet seen in France, which was the overweening pride of Greece and which in Constantinople was the sole reason for them to feel superior to thee, even that is now in the Palace of Aix. This may well be a warning to them that they must submit to the Frankish yoke. Didn't work out that way, but...
So how did the church feel about the organ at that point then?
The church had ambivalent feelings about the organ, and the reason they had ambivalent feelings is... two reasons. There's sort of the global reason, which is that it was felt that music in general, or at least music of any complexity that music that extended beyond a form of chant, was simply a distraction. It wasn't actually religious at all. It was playing to your physical sensory pleasure rather than, you know, elevating you to some spiritual connection with God.
Like Footloose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But there was, you know, as at any time, the church, though it claimed to, did not in fact speak with one voice. Some people in the church said, you know, no, this is as for the Frankish kings. This is an expression of greatness, of power, a representation of the power of the church and hence, you know, the divine presence in the world. And there was this, the Bishop of Baldric of a town called Dol wrote to some people in his town who had just bought an organ. Said, "It encourages me to reflect that just as diverse pipes of differing weight and size sound together in a single melody as a result of the air in them, so men should think the same thoughts and, inspired by the Holy Spirit, unite in a single purpose." And, you know, are we not organs of the Holy Spirit with the pipe? But the other problem is it wasn't just this sort of question about whether music in church or the first church organs were this, you know, these, as I say, they were manipulated by these pulls rather than a keyboard, and in some cases were clearly just optimized for sound. They were just supposed to be loud as hell and scare the bejesus, if I may use the term, out of their congregations. And you know, it wasn't always making these beautiful, sweet tunes. It was, you know, yes, D.A.C. you're right. There's an angry God out there, and you better be careful. But, you know, so you have the argument over whether, you know, music helps focus religious feeling or distracts from it. But what was really interesting was what happened when music itself became more complicated. You know, there was a move... beginning in the high middle, you know, in the middle, and then in the high Middle Ages, from classic church chant, which was all a single melody, to polyphony, two melodies, harmonies, music playing off itself, and you started seeing this develop, and you started seeing it actually produced by organs with with their keyboards when they got the keyboards back. You could play, you know, with 10 fingers, you can play 10 melodic lines if you're good. And that was a real challenge to the church. And it was a challenge, I think, for exactly the reason that Bishop Baldrick so welcomed music in that slightly earlier phase, because all of a sudden it didn't speak with one voice. And it began to reveal things that were perhaps corrosive of the idea of a single divine order in perfect patterns that human beings could investigate to confirm beliefs they already held. Because it turned out when you pushed beyond simply a melody of one note after the other, especially one note in a voice where you can adjust your tuning, it turns out that just the physics of the musical scale create problems. You can't have 12 notes in an octave, the sharps and flats, 12 tones, and have all the notes be in perfect harmony with each other. They won't be whole number ratios. If you build an octave out of three perfect thirds, the higher C above the C from which you started will be not a perfect 2-to-1 ratio in frequency, but something off, and it'll sound like heck. It'll just sound off. And these were very troubling discoveries, and that's what led people to try and invent tuning systems that would in some way allow more and more notes to be played harmoniously so it wouldn't sound bad when you struck two of them together. And there were a bunch of different systems that tried to place the distortions in different places until you finally came up with the well-tempered systems of Bach's era and ultimately the even-tempered systems that are now most commonly in use today for keyboard fixed-pitch instruments. You know, this is a big story. There's lots of music history books and so forth. But the thing that struck me there is as people investigated more and more closely and as they had the tools to test out the consequences of different ideas about sound, as you built an instrument with a keyboard and you tuned it in different ways and you heard different things come out of it, you began to get a sense of nature that was more complex, that didn't simply fall into the sort of abstract patterns you could build out of, you know, pre-modern scientific theory, like the Pythagorean cosmology of whole number ratios, and many others that followed it. And all of a sudden, science had a problem to solve. What was actually governing all this? How did the patterns emerge? What was the relationship of experience to underlying theory? And it's out of ideas like that. I'm not saying that people sort of saw the scale didn't work and then all of a sudden the scientific revolution happened, but I'm saying that problems like that of creating tuned instruments that produce the results you wanted were the kinds of problems whose solution led people in the end both to the mathematicization of nature and to the kind of inquiry, experimental inquiry, that put together make the scientific revolution.
You're tuned into Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back with more of Tom Levinson, author of Measure for Measure, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm on the air today with Tom Levinson, professor of science writing at MIT and author of Newton and the Counterfeiter and Measure for Measure, a musical history of science. While the first section of your book discussed the search for God's order, the next one looks at what happened when the expectations of that order didn't match up with reality. So we're moving into a way of thinking that more closely resembles the modern scientific method in an attempt to find out what's really going on in the world. Is that a reasonable summary?
Absolutely. I should note, by the way, that in the book, the musical instruments are alternated with scientific instruments. And so the transition from the perfection of the original ideas to the scale, to the sense that there are issues that the more closely you examine them reveal problems that have to be solved by methods beyond those that you use to figure out, for example, that you can build musical scales out of ratios. And that instrument is the microscope. And we don't need to go into it, but there are great stories about the microscope. It's just an unbelievably cool history. It's a great instrument. It's just lots of fun.
What does all this second section and the thinking about what actually is reality have to do with the cello?
Well, as I said, in the second part of the book, music goes from being a scientific practice to being the object of scientific inquiry. The first part of that section looks at the transition from alchemy to chemistry and really tells the story of how people went from this sort of, you know, sense of patterns of flow and flux and trying to understand ideas about change in matter from this pre-modern idea to the extraordinary outcomes you got when you started applying rigorous experimentation and very, very precise counting to what you were doing. And Newton, the greatest physicist of that first wave of the scientific revolution and the last great and probably greatest ever alchemist of the pre-modern era. I mean, Newton's this marvelous figure. You know, his left foot is still in some ways in very traditional science, and his right foot is, you know, pushing forward into the world of modern science that he's doing so much to create. He was the first quantitative alchemist, and work like his led people in the succeeding century to start trying to figure out what the fundamental nature of different substances really was. And the chemists identified the atomic nature of reality, the fact that, you know, carbon is a different substance than oxygen and exists in a particular ratio. Choosing anything as a standard, you can say carbon weighs so many hydrogens or so, you know, oxygen weighs a carbon plus a little, depending on which you use as your base, you know, standard of measurement. But they were able to show that, you know, that in fact, with these incredibly elaborate experiments, where in the end, the crucial instrument was nothing more complicated than a balance beam, a scale, very, very, very precise ones, very accurate ones, with experiments that took, you know, hundreds of steps, well, at least dozens of steps to perform, weighing the combinations of substances each step of the way, led Dalton and Berzelius and others to come up with these extraordinary results showing that, you know, in fact, the world is made of atoms. And in that context, I started looking back at, you know, what problem in the history of musical instruments illustrates the importance of and the difficulty of coming to clear understanding through measurement? Is there any problem this can't solve, or are there limitations to this as an approach? Because really, you know, the story of the development of the atomic hypothesis in chemistry is the story of a classical triumph of the scientific method as scientific revolutionaries imagined it. You construct an experiment, you build a hypothesis, you perform it carefully, you repeat it so you know what your error bars are, and you go on until you discover something that is unquestionably true about nature, and that knowledge is certain. There's nothing in material experience that cannot yield to this in the end. The question isn't, is it solvable? The question is, what do you have to do to solve it? I happen to know some people in the instrument-making world at that time, and I was struck by people telling me something that you hear a lot, which is, you know, the greatest violin family instruments ever were made by a relatively small number of people for a relatively short period of time in this one pretty small, not very important city in Italy called Cremona. This is where you have the founding genius of these groups was, I believe, Amati. And you had people like the Guarneri families, and you had, was it Niccolo Amati who was? I think it was Niccolo who was the first of the Amati family, who's credited with being this sort of leader of the high age of Cremonese wonderful violins, cellos, violas. And then there was the Guarneri family, which was several generations. And then there was Stradivari, who is the most famous of them all. There wasn't a whole dynasty of Stradivari family members, but Stradivari's two sons did continue the business for a bit. But really, it's Stradivarius himself. And, you know, people say there's nothing like a Stradivarius. Some people prefer Guarneri to Stradivarius for violins, and there's a, you know, there's always been a debate about it. But what was striking to me is if, you know, I mean, a violin or a cello or any of these instruments is a purely Newtonian kind of object. It's made out of wood and glue and gut strings originally, now different materials used for the strings, and different kinds of woods, and you put them together in a certain fixed way, and there are, you know, it's absolutely measurable. You can put your tape measure across, and you can see how high the front is arched, and you can see, you know, how long it is and how wide it is and how big the cutouts are and all that sort of stuff and what they've done with the F-holes. Everything, you know, there's nothing about it you can't know directly in terms of its physical dimensions. You can, with more effort and difficulty, discover things about its material properties, how stiff, what its breaking point is. I mean, you don't want to smash a Stradivarius violin, but you can approach questions of how rigid it is, how flexible. You can. One of the big things people have studied is the varnish, the protective covering that people put on these instruments. And, you know, cheap violins have a very hard sort of shellac, you know, fairly rigid varnish that makes the sound not so good as varnishes that fine varnishes that have different properties. You can study all that. My naive impression is, given all the stuff we know, and given that these really are bits of wood and varnish and glue, what's so hard about, you know, if you want another Stradivari, why don't you just make one? Of course, it ain't that easy. It's very curious as to why. And 20 years on, I can confess to you, I think my answer in the book isn't right. I had just finished working on a film about the then very new mathematical enthusiasm for the mathematical concept of chaos, which is a subset of mathematics that looks at systems that are extremely sensitively dependent on initial conditions. You know, it's the example people always bring up is the butterfly effect. A butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil creates an unmeasurable, undiscoverable perturbation in the atmosphere that ends up with tornadoes in New York yesterday, right? And that's true. I actually had the wonderful chance to interview Ed Lorenz, who is the MIT weather scientist, atmospheric scientist, who first discovered this effect and showed that, yes, in fact, the system is sufficiently dependent on the atmosphere as a whole. It's made up of all this stuff, you know, lots and lots of air. And it turns out that it's impossible. It's literally impossible to know its exact state at any one moment. And the slightest variation in that state can produce enormous variation as you go out through the days and discover that things have changed. And there are lots of other places in which chaotic dynamics apply and create unpredictable results. And I talked to lots of people, and there were people who were looking at chaos in music. And I thought that this was a pretty good explanation for why people found it so hard to actually reproduce what Stradivarius had done, because, you know, the idea there was that for all the measurements and for all the knowledge that people had developed about the different properties of the instrument, that they couldn't know it perfectly, and that very sensitive changes, very small changes, produced this result that differed from the intended goal. That's almost certainly not right. I mean, I did, in my defense, I wanted to say I showed it to some very, very good physicists who won't be named here because it was not theirs, and they didn't catch it. And that was, you know, this is actually a lesson for science writers. It's not good enough just to check your work with experts. You have to make sure the experts are specifically expert. My mistake was not in spending more time really deep in the acoustical physics community, which is very different from, you know, the physics faculty you'll find at a major university where the emphasis is on, the physics of materials, or, you know, theoretical physics about this or that, or, you know, all kinds of, you know, experimental physics, you know, experimental quantum physics, all these kinds of things. Those physicists know a great deal, and they'll be able to give you answers to the big concepts. But they do not. Nobody knows a neighboring subdiscipline as well as they think they do.
I have to say, I think it's kind of fitting that the cello is included in your section on science trying to figure out how the world really works, especially after you deciding that you're wrong. It's almost a better illustration of the progression of scientific thought.
I was wrong in my explanation, but the broad point is correct. I mean, first of all, it's proved difficult to precisely reproduce the sound of classically wonderful old instruments. It may be one of the issues is, can you make an instrument that sounds like a 300-year-old instrument that doesn't have 300-year-old wood and that doesn't have, you know, all the materials that have been aging? Because it's not clear that what's absolutely distinctive about this sound is the result of its initial construction or the fact that this has gotten old, right? You know, it, materials change over time. So lots of different ways that the sound can be affected. And there's ongoing arguments about how to make an ideal sound. And to me, the most interesting work is the work that's really studied in detail. What distinguishes the sound of a great Cremonese instrument as opposed to a really well-made instrument from the 20th or 21st century by an absolutely master luthier and all that sort of stuff. And one of the things it turns out is that the power spectrum, when you play a note, where most of the energy goes, is it in the fundamentals? Is it in what set of the overtones and so on? And it turns out there's a more complicated picture to the power spectrum of an old great instrument than there is of a new one. Again, that may be because of taste. We may, you know, modern concert halls are larger and so forth and so on. And so there's an emphasis on building an instrument that can produce an even, clear, good sound that fills the entire hall. There are lots of things from technology to the specific materials to specific issues of design and construction. Absolutely. I mean, Stradivari clearly made great instruments, and there was something that he did to get there. But there are lots of different ways that you interact with what you're working on to end up with the outcome that you get. Very complicated, very difficult, as you will see from this talk, to subsume into a single simple explanation, whether it be, you know, chaos or what have you. And thus difficult to come up with a complete, coherent, this is the scientific, you know, this is the formula for the cello, right? That's proved elusive. And that's the point that remains, is that there are many things that science can do directly, very easily. You know, if we're going to throw a ball, we can input all the parameters, how much force, if there's any wind, all that sort of stuff, and come up with a really good trajectory that ball will take. And we can make predictions about it. We can make predictions about it under different conditions and so forth and so on. You know, I mean, some of the first application of Newton's physics was on ballistics, you know, how not throwing a ball, but flinging a cannonball over some distance. And it really works great for that. But it doesn't work as well. Or rather, it takes a different kind of approach if you want to understand more complicated things. And certainly a cello is very complicated. But now, in modern science, and here's your transition, I hope, we're getting into things that are exceptionally complicated. And it turns out that the classical model, the sort of cartoon image of science as you come up with a hypothesis, you perform an experiment, you note down the results, and you confirm or disprove the hypothesis, that's not really what happens so much anymore.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and today we're discussing science and music with Tom Levinson, filmmaker and author of Measure for Measure, A Musical History of Science. And this is one of those times that I very much wish that my show was longer, because we have a lot of audience questions, and I have to make a choice between audience questions or my own questions. This one is from the chat, from SciCurious.
Music is heavily scientific and mathematical, but music that is composed purely on mathematical lines is atonal and sounds like crap. Why is that? Is it a bug or a feature of the system?
You know, that's such a long conversation. Note that Bach, in his late years, joined a scientific or natural philosophical society. And in order to join, he had to compose something that used a numerical, you know, used some numerical ideas to have these regularities. So I don't think it's fair to say that mathematically constructed music is inherently horrible sounding. You can certainly express mathematical concepts in music, and you can make them sound horrible if you wish, or you can make them sound odd and thought-provoking, or you can do things like the extraordinary, you know, counterpoint that Bach is famous for, and really show a play between the enormous intellect that's present throughout Bach's work and this glorious sensual pleasure of his music. I think the bottom line is, obviously, music is sort of the performance arts most closely derived from, kin to, beholden to the fundamental physics that give rise to sound and relationship, or describe sound and the relationships between sounds. So there are a lot of ways that science and music interpenetrate, and there are a lot of scientists who find enormous solace, enjoyment, pleasure, you know, thinking through making music on their own. But it's certainly true that if all you're interested in is in abstraction and manipulating abstractions and constructing them, you can create abstractly elegant music that sounds as horrible as you know, a hog stuck in a wallow.
That was beautiful. Last question. This is from Brandon.
How does the reason for studying science change the direction of scientific thought? For example, we saw with Bacon and Newton shifts away from a rigid theological motivation in science. Are we seeing another shift through the modern-day commercialization of science?
A couple things. First of all, science has always been commercial. Tisha B'Av built organs, and at least somebody built them and sold them, right? Back in 200 BCE. You know, Einstein held a couple of dozen patents and, you know, survived the German hyperinflation in good nick, in part because he was earning hard foreign currency with patents that included things for a gyroscope that submarines use to navigate and presumably, you know, do their dirty work underwater. So, you know, science has always been the investigation of relationships in the material world. It's never been entirely abstract. And even in, you know, people who really were committed to purely inquiry, like Isaac Newton, they understood, and in Newton's case, not directly in science, but in other work, performed very practical actions. We do science because we want to know how nature works, and we want to know how nature works because understanding how it works gives us a better shot at surviving until tomorrow. So I don't think the problem is that science has real-world applications. I do think there are real difficult issues today, not in the goal to take some, you know, really interesting insight and maybe a new molecule or material out that can affect, for example, human health. I don't think that's a bad thing to do. What I do think is very, very challenging, and it's something we have to push back on very hard, is where academic research is so unfunded by society that academic departments become essentially subsidized research departments for various corporations, and that as a consequence, research gets shaped in a way that doesn't respond to the imperative of the problem or the idea or the curiosity. And experiments, successful and not, outcomes, you know, get increasingly hidden behind, you know, trade secrets and corporate ownership. That, you know, that's really – science only really works if you can have crazy ideas and test them. And if the outcome of those crazy ideas is available to other thinkers who can then play with them or, you know, tease out what went wrong or any of those things. And if that license to think wildly and if the ability to communicate outside the silo of, you know, talking to your executive vice president of research at some corporation, if that goes away, then we have, you know, then we both have less science and, in fact, less positive, you know, material rewards for human well-being. And that is happening. There are people pushing back on it, and something we should all be aware of.
Tom, we're out of time, and that is distressing. I didn't even get to half of the audience questions or the conversation about future instruments and sort of that third section of your book. But thank you. Thank you for being here, sir.
It's great. Thank you.
You can find a link to Tom Levinson and his books, only one of which is Measure for Measure, and that's at our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're clicking links, try the ones to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+ to be the first to hear about show updates, and of course to iTunes so that you can listen to back episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a clever and witty review. And we'll be right back with Vaughn Masefield, Professor of Integrative Physiology at the University of Western Sydney, to talk about turning human emotions into playable music. And that's right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at new and evolving ways of bringing important science news to the public. Journalist and author Maren McKenna returns to the show to talk about her recent report on the evidence for a link between a common human infection and the overuse of antibiotics in chicken production. And Scientific American blog editor Bora Zivkovich gives us the scoop on the Best Science Writing Online 2012, a collection of last year's best science blog posts. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
So those new instruments that Tom Levinson and I were just talking about, here's one. Vaughn Macefield is trying to translate emotional activity into music. Vaughn is the foundation chair in integrative physiology at the School of Medicine, University of Western Sydney. He specializes in microneurography, which records information from single nerve fibers via microelectrodes inserted into the peripheral nerves of awake human subjects. He's known nationally and internationally as a world expert in human sensory motor and autonomic control systems. And that was very difficult to say, so thank you for coming to the show, Vaughn.
My pleasure.
Now, you're working specifically on trying to translate nerve impulses into music, so I want to make sure I understand exactly what we're talking about here. So what you're actually trying to read is electrical signals sent by nerve cells, correct?
That's right. So basically, by putting a fine microelectrode through the skin and into a peripheral nerve in a subject, we can tap into signals going to and from the brain. And for this, we're particularly interested in those originating in the brain, specifically those that provide the emotional markers, so the changes in sweat release and skin blood flow and hair standing on end. So if we tap into these signals which are supplying the skin, then we can record basically the signals from the brain. So basically it's like sticking needles into the brain, but much easier. This is a fairly straightforward technique that we use every day on healthy people and on patients with various conditions. But in this, I'm particularly interested, having recorded this sympathetic outflow under skin and seen how it is so critically dependent on emotional state, using these signals, which we just amplify, they're just electrical signals, so we can amplify them and convert them into sounds over loudspeakers. But actually now, with this Montreal-based performance artist, Aaron G, who's just been out in Sydney, actually converting the nerve signals into music.
Well, let's talk about the hardware that you're using to pick up these signals. How big are the electrodes that you're using?
Are you familiar with acupuncture needles?
Yes.
Well, I'm not, but I know that they are much thinner. They're about 200 microns in diameter, and they're made out of tungsten, and the tip is so fine you can't see it. It's insulated right down the very tip, so it has a very focal recording surface of a few microns. So you have to get right into the nerve and right close to a few nerve fibers. And if you imagine a bundle of nerve fibers is like a packet of spaghetti. You've got the big tubular spaghettis and the very small spaghettinis. These are the spaghettinis we're recording from, about a micron in diameter. Yeah, so these are the nerve fibers that transmit signals from the brain down to the blood vessels and sweat glands in the skin.
Well, now, are you able to actually read the activity of individual cells, or are we talking bunches of cells firing all at once?
Well, I do. In my research, I do record the activity of single nerve fibers, in particular single sympathetic nerve fibers, these very small ones. But for this purpose, all we need to record is the mass activity of 5 or 10 fibers, because they all travel in the nerve together. So we just want to sample the overall activity originating in the brain and innervating the skin. And by amplifying these signals 20,000 times through a computer-based acquisition system, we can then put them through Erin's software that she uses, which is Max MSP, and she then converts them through various thresholding and windowing features to drive synthesizers. So converting the individual spikes of electrical activity that we're recording into the sound of a glockenspiel, for instance. And we're also recording other physiological parameters like blood pressure and heart rate, respiration and sweat release and skin blood flow, and we can convert all of those into different sounds. We're very excited about this project because with a roboticist, Demi Taras, also at the University of Western Sydney, we're actually going to be interfacing these signals into robots. So the whole idea is that we know that when we have an emotional reaction, our heart rate increases, we get sweaty palms, cold and clammy palms. And it's because of those reactions that we experience the emotion. What we're wanting to do is externalize the emotion. So the body has its own physiological effectors, sweat glands, heart rate, breathing, etc. What happens if we amplify those and have them expressed by a robot or an avatar? So we can amplify a person's emotional reactions, and by having two people wired up like this, then we can see how one person's emotions can affect the others, because humans aren't that good at recognizing other people's emotions, and certain conditions such as autism spectrum disorders, they're notorious for finding it difficult to read people's emotions. And one of the things that we're talking about with a psychiatrist colleague here, Rochelle Van Root, who's originally from the NIH, Washington, she's now at Neuroscience Research Australia in Sydney, where I have a conjoint position. We're talking about using this as a tool to help these children recognize emotions in others by giving them amplified versions to work off.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Vaughn Macefield, Foundation Chair in Integrative Physiology at the School of Medicine, University of Western Sydney. We're discussing his new project working to translate the cellular expression of emotion into music. Okay, so let's go back just a step. How do you distinguish between the cells that are carrying emotional impulses versus cells that are carrying physical sensation, or they're involved in motion or something?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. Well, those involved in control of the muscles, they're in different parts of the nerve, those supplying muscles. But as you point out, those carrying sensation from the skin travel in bundles of nerve fibers called fascicles that are referred to as cutaneous fascicles because they supply skin. So it's quite easy to differentiate between a sensory nerve fiber or axon and a sympathetic axon that we're recording from, because the sympathetic bursts are occurring spontaneously, whereas with the sensory nerve fibers, you actually have to touch the skin or something. But this is what is interesting, because if we have a subject who's never had a microelectrode stuck in his or her nerve before, then they're usually quite anxious. And as soon as we switch on the amplifier, then we hear these loud bursts of activities. Once they calm down, it goes away because they're just relaxed. A loud shout will cause a brief burst, followed by sweat release and reduction in skin blood flow. If you ask them to have their eyes closed, the activity increases, you tap them on their nose, any unexpected stimulus will elicit a burst of impulses. Years ago, when my girlfriend at the time, was a subject when we were in Sweden, she was very, very calm, but all you had to do is mention shoes. Then whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. She's rather fond of shoes. So Aaron, the performance artist with whom I'm collaborating on this project, she was very, very anxious with the recording, and her sympathetic nerve activity was accordingly high. But then she was working on the laptop trying to get the signals in, and she calmed down. So all I had to do was just whisper her name behind her, and she came back into the zone. So, it's very labile. It's very sensitive to emotional state. The other role that it has is, well, its primary role is to control our body temperature. So these nerves, as I say, they supply sweat glands and blood vessels in the skin. So they're responsible for our skin going white when we're, cold, or they're responsible for sweating when we're hot. But these nerves have been commandeered as a means of emotional expression, not that just in humans, but in many animals. You know, a cat's hairs will stand up when they're afraid or aroused. So, yeah, they provide very useful means in other animals of indicating a particular state. And if you just imagine these, well, in Australia we have the blue-ringed octopus, and when it's aggressive, it has these bright blue rings that show up on it. But if you've seen these nature documentaries on these cuttlefish, you know, they just change their color according to emotional state and whatever they want, you know, their physical background. These are all supplied by the same nerves. So through evolution, they have taken on different roles, not just control of body temperature.
I want to try this so badly. Honestly.
Well, you're going to have to come over to Sydney then.
Now, your goal is to create a system where a person can use their emotions to basically perform a live score, right?
Yeah. In fact, I should tell you, what inspired me in this was years ago, I saw a dance crew from Montreal, La 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 Human Steps. I believe they're still around. They put a cardiac microphone on a member of the audience and played the heartbeat over the speakers. And as they danced, the tempo increased. Because that the person they put the microphone on was me, and I was thinking, oh, wow, you know, my heartbeat is changing the tempo at which they dance. And I was thinking, well, you know, I'm recording these signals, and we've got much more sensitive measures of emotion than just simply heart rate or sweat release. So, and then I saw Aaron, do this performance in Sydney with well-known performance artist Stellark, and I approached her afterwards, and yeah, we started chatting and went on from there. So we applied for a grant together for her to come back out to Sydney. And so she'll be back out here next year, but she's already got funding from Montreal to put on a show there in September next year. So we're working hard on getting that all together.
And so do you expect that we'll hear this music on the radio at some point?
Well, I hope so. And, you know, the idea of tapping into the brain and using those signals to control a wheelchair or a robot or a computer mouse, I mean, people have been working on this for a long time to help people with, you know, locked-in syndrome and spinal cord injury. And, you know, you can put electrodes in the brain or you can try and record the EEG from surface electrodes. But when it comes to motion, that's sort of more difficult to record than the nerve activity unless you actually stick a needle into the nerves. So I'm kind of surprised that this hasn't been attempted before, but yeah, we're pretty excited about it just because the nerve signals provide a much richer and crisper signal. It's more sensitive than sweat release, for instance. But as I say, we record all those things. And one of the things we're talking about is we record ECG, so you know we've got the heartbeat, the electrical activity of the heart, but we can also record blood flow in the finger, blood flow in the toe, and obviously the signals in the fingers and the toes are related to the beating of the heart, but they have intrinsic delays. It takes time for the blood to travel from the heart to the finger and takes longer to travel to the toe. So if we record those three signals, they're all time-locked to each other, but they have this delay. So we can convert those into sound chords. And we could have chords. We could have two or more people, each with their own resting heart rate, each with their own sensors in the fingers and toes, each generating different chords according to how long their arm and how long their leg is and their resting heart rate. So there's a lot of things that we're actually playing around with at the moment with the other signals as well as with the nerve signals.
I am going to be keeping close track of your research, sir. Thanks very much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.